Hi everyone, my name is João and I'm your host of the Software Crafts podcast. Today with me I have Gita. She's been an Agile coach at the leading companies like Spotify, Lego and IBM for more than a decade and has been independent since 2013. Her main focus in the last years have been communicating and implementing psychology safety as well as responsibility and accountability. It is essential for Gita to be authentic, to cut the chase and help people become themselves so they can succeed at work and outside. She also spends time being a speaker, mentor and trainer, and you have so far keynoted on 3 continents, but often about things that we forgot to talk about. Gita describes herself as curious, hippie, friend, hugger, geek and learner. And I can tell that this is true. Hi Gita, how are you?
Hi, I'm good, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. A bit hectic day, but good busy.
Good busy is good.
Yes, it is. So today we have a pattern, and the pattern is blameless inquiry. What is your opinion about it?
So when I looked at the pattern, I'm one of the people who are not very good with patterns. So when you said, oh, let's discuss a pattern heuristic, I was like, oh, no. But then when I looked at it, I'm kind of like, that is how I try to help people act. So if I look at blameless inquiry, which is very much about how do we look into things, problems, for instance, without blaming people, because if we put blame on people, we are not learning. So basically, that is what I'm using when I help people learn about how do we do a good retrospective. How do we give and receive feedback? It's very much about this blameless. So talking about what's a concrete action that happened? What's a concrete thing that happened? Not blaming the person for what happened, but just saying, this is what happened. If we are talking about a situation where you might have a post-mortem about something that broke down, actually looking into this and kind of looking at what happened, not, oh, Peter did that because this and that. Because that's not going to be helpful. We're not going to move on from that. It might feel good in the moment that you can just push it away and it's not you doing it, but it's not going to be helpful for us. And what we want to use all these things for, the feedback, the retrospective, all of it is about learning. And basically that's what we do in most of our companies. We are learning organizations. And if we can move away from the blame and into looking at what actually happened, what can we learn from this? What steps can we take, whether that is something we can obviously see this is a good thing to do, or it's something where let's do an experiment and figure out if this works. So that was kind of like my initial thought was kind of like, yeah, I get this. This is totally something that when I look at it, I incorporate in a lot of the things I talk to people about.
Very, very interesting. I'm fast and furious writing lots of questions. So you talk about sometimes it's satisfying to point the finger. Do you recognize that sometimes we need to do that, or this should be avoided all the time?
I would avoid it if I could. I mean, there is something... For me, it's a little bit like if you would eat candy all the time, that would also be satisfying, but it wouldn't be good. Candy sometimes is okay, but when we come to blaming people, it is a defense mechanism, which is about us not taking responsibility. So if we say, oh, this has gone wrong and it's somebody else's fault, that is pushing away responsibility from ourselves. And there are 2 things in that. One is that blaming people is a really poor way of interacting with people. But the other is that by blaming other people, we remove every kind of choice from ourselves. Because if it's somebody else's fault, we cannot do anything about it. And when we have these things, especially in the workplace, we want to be able to do something about it. So what we need to look at is, what can we do? Where can we create something? Where can we change something? Because if it's just somebody else's fault, it may feel good in the moment to just, you know, yell at that person or just talk about them behind their back. But first of all, it's not going to help the situation. Second of all, it's also going to make us feel bad. And it's going to create a environment of unsafety, because if you're sitting in that room and you hear us talk about someone that's not in the room, for instance, or even talking to someone in the room, what you are hearing might be the words that we say right now, but what you're feeling is, what if I'm next? What if I'm the next one being blamed, the next one being talked about? And that makes you feel unsafe. And if you feel unsafe, you're not going to do the things that make a workplace really interesting. You're not going to be the one that takes a small risk to see if we can learn something. You're not going to be the one that asks the question, because what if I ask this question, or what if I do this thing and then something goes wrong, then everyone is going to blame me. So it creates a culture of not taking responsibility, but also a culture of unsafety in the team, or whatever the team, company, whatever session it is or container it is.
Thanks. This is something that I need to ask to challenge you, but I think where we are going. And this pattern is in the context of teams, right? Postmortems, retrospectives. How about individuals? How about that person that takes to personal and blames herself or himself about things that that person did? How can we try to change that mindset that in the end can help the team?
I think that's something we also need to work with, because I think a lot of us, including myself, have been brought up with feeling shame about not doing things right. It's something that's very built into, especially the Western society. And I mean, so many parents will go, you should be ashamed of yourself. I like to use what Brené Brown writes about. She kind of distinguishes between guilt and shame, where guilt is about something we do and shame is about something we are. But sadly, the way our society very much talks to us is that you do something wrong, you are stupid, not you did something stupid. And that's kind of how most of us have been brought up. But I think if we can start changing the language into, even when we speak to ourselves, so instead of saying, oh, I'm so stupid, I did this, start saying, I did a stupid thing, because you are still okay. What you did might be stupid, but you are okay. And I think we kind of need to work on our language that way, even if it's individual or teams, so that also when we communicate with each other, we go and we just, if somebody says, oh, I'm so stupid, I did this, you can say, no, you're cool, you just did a stupid thing. We all do that. I mean, we all make mistakes. That's, I usually say, that's why we have the backspace on our computers. Otherwise it wouldn't be there. And to create an environment where we talk about, you know, you did something stupid instead of you are stupid, we can start building that where it's not about you personally. It's about an action that you do, because our actions and our behavior is something we can change. It might be hard because like you and I talked about earlier today, we have muscle memory, so to say, also in our behaviors. So it might be hard to change a behavior, but it is possible. Who you are is not something I believe we should change. I think if we try to change who we really are, essentially, we will damage ourselves. But our behaviors, how we speak, I think that is what we need to change. And if we can bring focus to that in our daily conversations, in our meetings, whether it's the full team or one-on-one, we can start moving away from this personal, whether it is blaming somebody else or taking the shame upon yourself.
Thanks, and this is very relevant, right? I'm myself and my wife, we are raising a little kid, so I'm reading a lot, and the my wife just finished a book that I need to read, that is The Danish Way of Parenting. And actually, this is relevant because you are Danish, so you probably know a bit more than I, but talks exactly about this point, and that's why I was challenging you not blame ourselves. And yes, we do mistakes, and yes, we don't take into account all the information, we still make decisions, but in the end is this guilty versus shame that you frame very well, that is amazing. And you talk in the beginning about learning organizations and when we point fingers about removing choice. Do you think that the organizations need to keep options open? And if so, how do we do that?
But I think by removing responsibility from ourselves, by talking about that it's somebody else's fault or it's my fault because I'm so stupid, I don't necessarily mean we need to keep choices open. But by removing that, we give ourselves the choice to actually make that choice. It's not that we keep the options open forever. But if I say the server broke down again, it's Peter's fault, then I can't do something about it. I don't have a choice. I don't have an option to do anything about it. Whereas if I say the thing that you committed yesterday made the server broke down, let's look at that and see if we can figure out what's wrong with that code. Then it's more about the code, than it's about Peter committing it, because that's irrelevant. It could be anyone. And that also makes it a choice. I can help him now. If it's just him being stupid, I can't do anything about that. That's not something I have. So that's how I meant it, is that when we are talking about these things, if we can move it over to the concrete things, we can take responsibility for it. We can say, okay, I know Peter's moved on to a different project, so now I take it on and I look at this. Or, we have this option all the time of going in and making those choices for ourselves. But if we keep saying that everything that goes wrong is somebody else's fault, well, then we can't fix it. We can't fix the things in our team if it's the management's fault, all of it. That doesn't mean that there are not things pushed down at us that makes it a lot more difficult for us. But very often, I think we talk about things as if it's definitive. Like, I've talked with some people, for instance, who talk about really hating their jobs, for instance, individuals. And I say to them, have you considered quitting? And they say, no, I can't quit. That's not a possibility. And most of the time, it is an option. But you can't quit and still have the same lifestyle that you have now. I mean, now during Corona, it doesn't matter. But you can't. Maybe you can't quit and travel 3 times a year. Or you can't quit and get the new phone as soon as it comes out. But very often, you can actually quit. And then say, we're going to have our vacations at home this year. Or, you're not going to get the new phone. And then you can, so often for instance like that, we can actually lower what we have. But often we don't see the choices in front of us. We go into a room and because the tables are where they are, that's where we sit, even though it doesn't make sense for us. And if we go like, it's this company, they put the tables in a stupid way, we remove our option to make a good working environment. But instead we say, oh, it's so annoying, these tables are in the way, let's move them around so that we can actually see each other when we collaborate. Then we take the option back to ourselves. We can take the choice back to ourselves instead of just being dependent on somebody else. But I actually do think it's important to close things, because way too often we tend to want to keep things open as long as possible. But we forget that having an option open also has a cost. It's not just the cost of making the decision. It's also sometimes the cost of not making a decision.
Very, very interesting. And I see lots of ideas flowing. But thanks for clarification and bringing all of these examples. I see now the removing the choice or getting the choice back. And I just love that the examples of the shares. We don't need permission to change the layout of a room unless things are attached to the floor. I saw that. But more for good reason. So it's very, very, very interesting. So about learning organizations, and you talk also about in your daily job, you help teams to acquire new tools or techniques to go to a learning organization. How do we do that? Because not all organizations have this in the DNA. How we help organizations to become more flexible, to become learning?
I think that one of the things we need to do is to actually help them understand that to succeed, at least in our industry, you do need to be a learning organization, because we are creating new things all the time. Software gets, even the things that we use to create our software, for instance, is new all the time. we want to make experiments because we don't have the solution. I mean, if we had the solution, we would just sit down and code it. Then, you know, then all development would just be typing in. And that's not a problem. I mean, that is a problem, actually, because that would be really, really boring for everyone. But what we do is a learning and talk to people about this and start, I've been working with psychological safety, for instance, where Amy Edmondson, who has a really good TEDx talk, actually talks to people about, or when she talks there, about the high performance happens when we are a learning organization. When we have a push for performance, which can be internal or external, that is safe for us. That's when we really become the place where we learn. And if you become a learning organization, that's where we get. So helping people listen, for instance. So ask questions and be curious about things. That can be one thing. Help people be that. But also when we come in, so like I'm an agile coach. When I come in, I model that. I model that curiosity. I model that, oh, that's interesting. Why are you doing this way? Can you explain that more? Because I haven't seen it this way before, but it sounds like it helps you. So please explain it to me. So instead of, you know, going in with the attitude of this is right and this is wrong, helping them understand that this is a learning journey, that there is no right and wrong. In most of our cases, there are not even best practices. There are good practices. And it would be so nice if we had best practices. If we could just, you know, pull up a list and say, if you just do these five things, everyone will be happy. But that's not how life is. And what works for one team or one organization might not work for another. So that's also something we need to help people understand and talk to them about, preferably with the leaders of whatever we are working with. If it is a team, it might even be the unofficial leaders. If it is an organization moving higher up, because if it comes from above, it's usually better. I mean, you can create safety, you can create curiosity, you can create that inside a team. But if the organization is not safe, then they're just going to do it in the team and they're still going to be, you know, they're not going to have the choices. They're not going to have the learning because they don't have those options. But actually helping them understand that learning is essential and that learning is not just sitting down and reading a book or taking a class or whatever. It is also trying things out. Maybe sitting with someone, I like pair programming, for instance, or pair writing or pair teaching or pair coaching. I don't think it should only be limited to programming. Sitting down with someone and maybe being the one who doesn't know as much has the value of you asking the questions, which might feel stupid to you. But my experience is that the one that knows the least asks the questions about the things that we forget why we do. Stuff that we've been doing for years, and it might have made sense, you know, ages ago. I was talking to someone about Haskell, it's probably called. So when I learned about Haskell originally and tried to make a backgammon game when I was studying computer science, you could not save anything. Everything was just functions and variables, which meant that you had to send the whole backgammon board everywhere. And I don't code functional anymore. Actually, I don't code anymore. And I know there's now something called monads, which means you can save something. But if I had only worked with the other stuff and I was doing that, I would never save anything because that was not in the way I learned it. And if a new person comes in and said, oh, by the way, do you know you can save? Why are you not saving anything? And I'll go like, well, you can't. It's functional. And he'll go, no, actually, we have monads now, for instance. You know, then we would be able, I would go like, oh, that's really interesting. Maybe we don't do these things. And sometimes when we do something, especially for a long time, we forget that the limitations that were there, you know, when we started learning this might not be there anymore, or there are new limitations. So by pairing up and learning that, but that's a really, really good way of learning no matter what you do.
I definitely agree with you. I'm a big fan of these learning mechanisms. Even my previous engagement as consultant in the team that I was, I start alone and then we scale with more people in the role, externals, consultants like me, and is what I call doing onboarding on and pairing, rather than show to the people, oh, this is the document. Just brought the person with me to 1 week of meetings. Okay, this is the type of challenges that you might have. It's a big organization, so might be different because different business units. But I run the show like this. Now we can go into the content of the show itself. But these are the challenges that quite work. And at the same time, because they are also experienced consultants, they question, did you question about this and that? Which led me to the bias part. I was more and more aware about my bias and things that I could not see. And I also believe that it can be a very good way to map our bias that can increase psychology safety. Because if I am aware about the bias that affect me, I can, in one point in time, stop myself and ask myself, reflect.
Yeah.
Do you encounter this in your job, that these people becoming more aware of the bias as they increase the psychology safety?
Well, often they don't know that it's called biases and stuff, but that doesn't matter. When they start becoming aware that, you know, they have been trained or conditioned to see things one way, once they become aware of this, I think that's kind of step one, is to become aware of it. I'm not sure if we can ever change our biases totally, but if we can become aware of it, we can kind of create a little bit of space between our own reaction and what actually comes out of our mouth or what action we do. And in that, I saw someone that says, between impulse and reaction, there's a space. And in that space lies the free will. And so when we get an impulse, we can start making those, if we have that space, if we can create that space, which takes a while to kind of get used to, even though, you know, your initial reaction might be one thing, if you know what, I'm actually quite biased in this, then you can start going, I'm just going to take a deep breath and then I'm going to give a different answer than I originally did. And I think biases are a little bit scary in a way, because they are there, but we might not know it. I took a test, I can't remember which university it is, that has like a test you can do on biases. And I am very biased against women, for instance, which surprised me a lot, because a lot of what I try to do is to help women feel safe and in IT, but also just go into tech, because tech is awesome. Tech is awesome. We have a lot of people we don't bring in. We have the men who are not coming in today because they don't think it's for them. We have all the women and non-binaries that don't there. We have, we have all kinds of cultures and ages who don't come in. And for me to kind of see, okay, I'm actually biased against women, was really difficult for me. So I think that when people start looking into this, it's also good if they can get some help to talk about this at least. But I do see that it increases safety, that if you know this is how you react, you can start acting in different ways, but you need to know it first. Our brain does it because it helps us. Stereotyping, for instance, helps us. We cannot digest all the information that we get. So by putting things in buckets, our brain can handle it much better. And sometimes those buckets are good for us, and sometimes they are really bad for us. For instance, I once had someone say to me that I was not a real woman because I studied computer science, because his bucket of women did not fit in with computer science. And the reaction he got from me, I think, convinced him that that bias was not a good one to have. but for instance, that bias that kind of makes us make these judgments, it's not good for us, and it doesn't create that safety, because that means that, let's say you have a bias against women, that would mean that if a female developer speaks up, you might not take her serious, even though, you know, she's the only one who saw the problem with this code. So becoming aware of that, first of all, it's good for you because you actually listen to her and as a group, because we create a better product. But also the safety in that she is taking serious, for instance, that she can actually raise a problem without someone patronizing her, for instance. Now I'm just using women as an example, but you know, there are tons of biases. I just know this one really well because I was so surprised that I had it myself. But I do believe if we can become aware of these things and see what of my actions are actually, you know, kind of following this bias. And is there something I need to change about that? Asking ourselves those difficult questions like, okay, do I not listen to that person because she's a woman or because there might be a different culture? When I was working, one of my first jobs as an agile coach, we had a lot of Indians because they wanted to outsource. So we had kind of the Danish people and then we had the Indian teams in India. And there was very much in the whole organization, the Indians were just resources and they were not as good. They were just cheap, which meant that there was not a respect about these people. You were not asking them the questions that could actually help you. The first time I had to do a distributed retrospective where I had people in more areas, I asked the Indian agile coach I was working with, because he had been working distributed for a long time. And afterwards he told me he was so surprised that a senior coach like me would ask him for help. And to me, this was just obvious. Like, he's tried it before, I haven't. And I had never considered why should he be less valuable because he's an Indian. I mean, if we look into making a software that reflects Danish culture, yes, then he has a big disadvantage because he's not born in Denmark. He doesn't know how we act and think. But when we talk about running a distributed meeting, he was way ahead of me. So I think that by having these biases and not being aware of them, we miss out on so much that could help us become better as a collective, but also for us as individuals to learn. And it's nice to kind of think that I know everything, but it's not true. And the more you know, the more you will find out that you don't know, which is very frustrating, but it also means you can learn something from anyone because they know something you don't know because you don't know everything. So there's always this learning opportunity, always this growing opportunity. And I think our biases sometimes prevent us from seeing these things.
I totally agree, and I thanks to share these personal stories about you, but also illustrate the examples, right? The bias exists as a evolutionary mechanism because our brain consumes lots of energy, really lots of energy.
Yeah.
That's why we have bias to put things in boxes and do not use energy. But I just love your examples, how the bias led us to take bad decisions. And now being aware of them can lead us to do good decisions, like the last example that you show, just perfect. Now I'm going to change the topic and I'm going to uncharted territory. Mm-hmm. In your bio, you say that you like to talk about things that we forgot to talk about.
Yes.
What are those things?
So one of the things I talk about is mental health, for instance. I think it's a big problem that we only talk about mental health when it is a problem. If we have somebody who needs to go on sick leave because they have stress, for instance, we might talk about it. Or, you know, we might talk about when they come back. But talking about mental health in general and having it as, instead of having it as a taboo, actually something we talk about, not just about the problems that we have, but also like right now we are all at home. And it's not like people choose to work from home or the companies choose that we work from home. It's where we are. And for me, for instance, I'm single, and I work from home, which means I don't see anyone. And humans need contact. People I know who have like 3 kids, sometimes they have to homeschool them. They are never, ever alone. And we need to talk about these things. I talk about imposter syndrome, the fact that a lot of us feel, even though we get a lot of really good feedback, and prove that we are good enough, we kind of go, maybe I'm just fake. Maybe one day they will find out. Like I said earlier, I'm really bad at remembering all the biases and patterns and heuristics. And sometimes that makes me feel like I'm not a proper agile coach because I should know these things. And that feeling of not being good enough and that somebody will find out. Every single time I have done the talk about imposter syndrome, somebody comes up to me either virtually or in a conference and goes, I thought I was the only one. I thought I was the only one in my whole organization, maybe the whole world, who felt this way. And I think we need to address these things. I also talk about being more human at work. I think we have kind of made being professional into being, we don't have emotions and we are robots at work. When really, I mean, we are making amazing stuff sometimes. And if we bring ourselves in, we can make it even more amazing. Like if you look at physical products, for instance, bulletproof vests have not been designed for women. So there are actually some women in SWAT teams who had their breasts removed to be able to wear a bulletproof vest. The crash test dummies that we have used to test our cars for many years are the average size of a man. Not all men are average. Not all people are men. We have women, we have kids, we have, you know, dwarves, for instance. That is only something that has been started to look into the last few years. And by bringing ourselves in, we can say, oh, wait, that doesn't test me. Why doesn't it test me? And by the way, a really awesome thing I think is, I don't like to make advertisement, but Volvo actually put out 40 years of research open to all other car manufacturers because they have used different crash test dummies of all sizes, and they put that available for everyone after they found out that not everyone was testing this way.
Well, Volvo is well known by what they did with the three-point seatbelt in the 70s, something like that, when they developed the three-point seatbelts, and they just said, well, this belongs to humankind because this will be everyone saved. So I think that in that case, it's their DNA.
But that's also a thing, I think, that is, for me, a really good example of something that is in abundance. Information is in abundance, and by sharing it, that way. I mean, you could say, oh, they want to keep everything so they can be the best. No, they want to share it so everybody can use this. And it's not making them any smaller, but it's making the rest of us bigger. And for me, that's also what all this is about being human, about being sharing. And I mean, if I can be human at work, if I can just bring myself, not thinking about, you know, am I good enough? Am I dressing the right way? Am I, you know, do I have to put on a facade because I have emotions? I think that is damaging to us. You said earlier, like our brain uses so much energy. Why use more energy on putting on a facade? Plus, that means that I'm not going to bring that in. And even if I just, you know, I get angry at some software program when I'm testing it, that means that program causes a reaction in me, and I'm probably not the only one that causes a reaction in. So that is something that we would not learn if I didn't bring my emotions to work. That would not, so we can create better products that way. And I talk about these things, mental health, psychological safety has started to become something that everyone talks about. I also talk about the fact that we can't just expect people to do things without teaching them. I've heard so many times, oh, I expect people to be grown-ups and take responsibility. But if you worked for 20 years in an organization where people told you what to do, you went to school where your teacher told you what to do, your parents told you what to do, we can't just go, ta-da, and now everyone takes responsibility. Or expecting people to be able to give and receive good feedback. I mean, even if we talk about just programming, we have code reviews or pull requests or whatever form you do it in. That is also feedback. And we're just expecting people to do all these things. But nobody helps them learn it. So those are the things I talk about. But I think the thing that most people probably relate to when I say the things we don't talk about. It's probably stuff like, you know, mental health, taking care of each other. I used to not call myself a hippie because, you know, it sounds a bit crazy. But I decided, you know what? Hippie basically means I believe we should have more love in whatever form that is. I mean, caring for someone you work with is also a form of love, even though now the way we often use it in our language is something else. I want to make the world a better place where there's more space for different kinds of humans. I want us to respect each other, to not just accept each other, but to, you know, be with each other, have that kind of, you know, take advantage of our differences. And if that's hippie, then I'm a hippie. So I decided to put it on my profile.
And a very, very good hippie, I must say. And I just love your description of bringing the wholeness to the workplace. Do you feel that after these years talking about these things that we don't talk about, is people becoming more aware of it? Or we still have a long way to go?
Yes and no. I think we still have a very long way to go. But the fact that we now actually have conferences in IT who talk about these things, like recently I did my talk on stress and depression at a conference called It Matters, about the things that matter in IT, where we talked about things like that. There was a conference last year in London, which is called Beyond Tech, where we talked about ethics, where we talked about diversity and inclusion, because it's not enough for us to have different people. We need to all be invited to to be part of the table. So to say, we need to be included, not just be a number in a statistic. So I do see this coming up, but I also encounter a lot of companies where this is not taken serious, where mental health is not something you talk about. And if you are open about your mental health, it's shut down. Sometimes I see organizations that give me hope, organizations that work with this, that bring in, allocate. I know one company, for instance, that allocates a week when it's a mental health awareness week. They have sessions for people. They bring in, they're a big company, so they can bring in good speakers. But like this year, they had Brené Brown, for instance, come in and talk about having the courage to be yourself, having the courage to take leadership, for instance. So I do have hope, but we have a damn long way to go. And I see some people pushing back to all of these things, as in, they call it the cancel culture. So that if somebody who's really mean is not invited to a or is invited and then asked not to come because the organizers find out that that person is mean, it's a cancel culture. To me, it's not about canceling. It's about if you are a conference, you have the choice of what speakers you want. You have a choice of what signal are you sending. Are you sending the signal that stuff you can read in a book is more important than having a conference where women actually dare to come? And even though that seems like small things, I do see that these things are happening. There are people who actually now get the consequences of our actions. Yes, we have freedom of speech, but freedom of speech does not mean that there are no consequences. There will be consequences. If I called you something nasty now and started yelling at you, that is my free will or my freedom of speech. But that would mean it would damage our relationship, and that is a cost that comes with free speech. I mean, with great power comes great responsibility, as they say in Spider-Man. Yep. But freedom of speech is a great power. But that also comes with responsibility, and it comes with consequences. I actually like Pippi Longstocking better, because he says, if you are very strong, you have to be very nice. And I think that's what we need to learn, is that with the powers that we all have, because we are all very strong in a lot of areas. We need to be nice. We need to be kind. That doesn't mean we don't have conflicts. It doesn't mean that we can't disagree or have different opinions. But it means we do it in a respectful way. And it means that, and I see things popping up here and there. But sometimes I just want to, you know, crawl under the blankets in my bed and just say, I'm not sure I should curse on it, so I won't. I'll just beep.
I think that I have some sound like that.
And I have those days where I don't believe in that we're getting anywhere. But then I also see things where I kind of go, you know what? There are light at the end of the tunnel, because it's coming up here and there. And the new generations that are growing up now, the kids that are growing up now, at least some of the ones I meet, really give me hope. The fact that they reflect about things. If we talk, for instance, about sexuality, the fact that even at a young age, my best friend's girl, who's kind of a little bit mine, you know, she's kind of like knew that two girls in her class was lesbian. And I mean, probably some were lesbian in my class. I mean, if I look at the statistics, there must be. But I never knew of it. I mean, it was nothing you talked about, because it was like, yeah, it was okay, but it was also strange. And I see with the kids nowadays, it's not strange. It's, you know, you can love, I usually say you can love whoever you want, and it's cool as long as you're grown-ups and there is consent. Why should we even care about that as long as people are happy? Let's spend focus on things that are not good instead.
Exactly. And yeah. You have been doing a great work, I see. So I like off one model of Elliot Jacks about the levels of work, the work that we do today, and see, like, I can do my dinner and see how my dinner looks like, is too salty or not. So is the first level, until the work like Galileo, the heliocentric versus geocentric, that takes centuries to have ripple effect. I think that your work is level 8 or 9, this type of work that will take a few generations. But as we keep speaking up, more people will pick up. But you are already describing that in our lifetime, we are seeing small changes that give us hope. So let's have hope and let's be kind as a first step towards this.
Yeah, and I mean, we can all do things. Sometimes we feel like we don't have influence, but we do.
Yeah, the butterfly effect, right?
Yeah. You meet someone, you know, you hold the door for them. They feel a little bit happier, which means that, you know, they might go home and kiss their husband instead of, you know, being angry because they couldn't get through the door. And all of a sudden, there's a whole different mood in that home. I mean, we can all do things. And sometimes things that are really small for us would matter for someone else. Like if you have a car and somebody doesn't, you know, you can give them a lift that might take you 5 minutes. It would take them a half an hour with a bus. That makes a huge difference for that. And I think there's small things we can do all the time that matters a little bit to us, but a lot to somebody else. Holding the door, actually seeing someone, maybe listening to someone. I don't think we listen nearly enough to what other people are saying. We are very good at speaking in our culture, but we're not very good at listening.
Can imagine. But I also know someone that created a workshop for that, right?
Yes.
So follow up Kite workshop. I never experiment myself, but my good friend Kenny did. And he said that the first part is really, really pushing, because we have this tendency to talk. So if you are over there next time that Kite is in town, go to her workshop so you can experiment what she's talking about. So we are in the end of this episode. And the last question is the resources, books or podcasts or courses or communities that you recommend
I mean, I think if you want to look into some of these things, two TED Talks that I recommend is one by Amy Edmondson about developing good teams that talks about psychological safety. And what's good about that is it talks from a company perspective, like what's in it for the company, not just about makes us feel better, which it also does, but what's in it for the company. Brené Brown has a TED Talk on vulnerability and why that is essential for us. Why being brave actually also means being vulnerable. And she's a person who goes in and does consulting in like some of the biggest companies in Silicon Valley. The book called The Five Dysfunctions of a Team, I think is so good. It's one of the business stories. So it's like a story told about this management group that's not working together. And a new person comes in and helps them become a team. And those five levels that are the five dysfunctions that are in there, where the first one is absence of trust, I think is essential for teams, whether teams means a group of people working together, a management team. Those are really essential for building good relationships. And the book Crucial Conversations, which is about how we communicate. And then just care about each other. Be curious. Maybe pick up a book you would never pick up. Maybe pick up maybe listen to a random podcast. Who knows what you will learn?
Really nice suggestions. So the formal ones I will put in description of this episode. I also will tag you with your social media so people can tell you what was the random podcast that they pick up. That will be a nice exercise.
Oh, please do. I am on Twitter with Native Wired, and I'm always happy to communicate with people.
Cool. So to close this off, I want to thank you for your time, for sharing these insights with us. Thanks very much.
Thank you for inviting me.
No problem. It was a pleasure. You can follow us on Twitter at @scraftspodcast. Visit our website softwarecraftspodcast.com or follow us on LinkedIn under Software Crafts Podcast. Talk to you next week.